Good evening.
Good evening.
So today we're going to we will start with a bow. That's always a good idea. Today we're going to continue the work of exploring emotions. And we're going to examine several ways of viewing and working with emotions. So what we all want is to realize our mind as Buddha mind, as our own natural mind, as our natural wakefulness, to fully inhabit our human condition without hesitations or confusions. And when we want to do this, we find that there are obstacles, and the obstacles are generally the what are called the two veils that obscure our vision and prevent us from realizing our natural mind. We've been told that we really do have Buddha mind, but somehow we find ourselves without the confidence that this is so. We have a problem actually believing it. So the problem is what we call the two veils. And the primary veil is the veil of false view, the veil of seeing ourselves as separate from the world, so that it seems like there's me here, and then there's everything else which is there, which includes other people, material things, ideas sometimes, molecules, galaxies. Sometimes it even includes our own body, because our body seems to be something else. We can't keep it from getting sick, aging, and so on. So this veil has been compared to the roots and the trunk of a very sturdy tree. And from that arises the second veil, which is the veil of thoughts and emotions. And it's very hard to go directly at the tree to say, I'm going to cut down this tree, I'm going to just root it up. We've been advised by great teachers that we have to start with the leaves and the twigs. We start with these because they're much easier to understand, and we can actually grapple with them, get to see them, become familiar with them. So we're using one technical term, klesha, which we've described before. Klesha can be translated as conflicted emotion. And the reason we use a technical term is because the word emotion is too vague, or there are too many different opinions about it. Psychologists cannot agree on what is an emotion. So we use the term klesha because we can use it very precisely. So envy, pride, resentment, hatred are clearly kleshas, conflicted emotions. And joy, love, and compassion are not kleshas. So we can refine this and talk about it during discussion. So we've been told that kleshas are always pure energy plus a storyline. And that storyline is always about me. The energy is our pure power of our enlightened nature. It's the juice that makes it possible for us to be fully human. We wouldn't want to give that up. We cannot give it up. It's colorful and awake. And then there's a storyline about me. So we have energy and a storyline. We've been through that a couple of times, I think. So as we sit here, each one of us has our own collection of stories which we dwell on, stories which we repeat, stories which we elaborate, and they go on all the time in our minds. And it's somewhat like a cow that can always bring up its cud and chew on it and digest it a little further.
Oh boy.
Oh, did we not say that before?
It's just a good image, but isn't it? Can't we talk about ice cream or something?
Ah, some other question.
It's on your little corner of the
board. Right, exactly.
So we all have many clashes. So here is Michael, who has a history of resentments so embarrassing I wouldn't want to describe them. And sometimes the resentment is caused, I'm resenting someone who basically did a better job with something than I did and enjoy some benefit, and I didn't do it right, and so I don't have that benefit. So I feel envious, I feel resentful, and maybe I feel a little morally superior because I don't do without that particular Oh, welcome.
Thank you.
Would you like to join the circle?
I would love to, actually. I was looking for Ruth, and she doesn't appear.
She's not here.
Oh. No. She's not here. I actually have a letter of recommendation for her that I wanted to give her, but I apologize.
Okay. Well,
it's okay.
Probably not in Waltham now, I would say.
She was?
She was?
Last weekend, right?
She was here on Sunday.
I saw her Sunday, right?
Yeah.
Well, again, I apologize for interruption.
No problem. Okay, so where were we? Okay, so this Michael here maybe feels, well, I'm a little superior to this guy. I don't have to go for those things that he's got. But that's kind of like sour grapes, isn't it? Which is another kind of klesha. And then there are all these little secret greeds, which I have to cover up, and little bits of contempt and shame and guilt and secret desires and secret hatreds and so forth. So it's really, in some ways, a wonderful movie. If someone could make a cinema of it, what would they do? That a skilled director would reveal it not by stating everything, but by showing body language, posture, speech hesitations, all sorts of techniques, mood, lighting, music, and would somehow tell the whole dramatic story, and it would be a real work of art. And Marty has her own story, and that would be a different one. It would have different details, and it would have different secrets, and it would be another beautiful work of art, a wonderful cinema. And Mary would have hers. And we each have our own. So we all have these wonderful treasures which we're hoarding, each one so brilliant, so original. So we put so much energy into polishing it and making it juicy. So, by the way, we don't have any confessors in this practice. unlike the Catholics, you have to do it all yourself. We aren't going to bring these all out into the open by confessing them.
Everyone's very happy about that.
Everyone's very happy about that. You have to do all the work yourself. Okay.
And it's no unison prayer of confession either. Huh?
Pardon?
No unison prayer of confession. That's not the Catholic. That's sort of the Protestant version.
So each is so unique. Should we be very proud of these? Well, or maybe we shouldn't. What if someone, some great teacher, even before we were born, had already read our minds and said, you think this is so brilliant and original, but every little piece of it, every little nut and bolt of all this brilliant, creative edifice you've made, I can show you it falls into just one of eight little types. And each one is a way in which it's about me. And there's only eight of them. So we have a kit for dismantling the whole thing. And so I want to thank Ms. Linda, right? Who looked back at what we did in this, in the, when was it, the fall?
The
spring.
I told Emily that what I was doing in my meditation I found very useful were the eight, when we learned the eight worldly dharmas.
Right.
I found very useful. I was trying to connect some stuff. And like, why does it, that actually be able to like hold the pain or something?
Yeah.
Ooh, what does this feel like? Oh, what's this? And then I connected it to the eight worldly dharmas, and I see these repeated patterns, and I pinpointed a couple of the ones that are my big places, I guess.
But we all do all of them, and there's only that many things. We've said that the storyline is always about me, right? And here's just eight ways it's about me. Wow. That's quite a powerful piece of analytic tool, isn't it? So I was thinking we could have a little discussion about that, and people could, maybe someone can pick out one of the particular ones of the eight and describe how it creates a story about me. And when we do this, I'd like to plead with everyone here that the subtle things that go on in our mind are really the important ones. And yes, there are big eruptions. Big eruptions occur because we're unaware of everything going on in our minds. And there's a boiler going on there, and the steam is building up, and we haven't bothered to look at the pressure gauge, and then it surprises us. But what's going on all the time, all the subtle kleshas are the important ones. And there are so many different ones. And our time is so precious, so please let's not drive into the pit of road rage and anger management and spend the next half hour there. Do you follow me?
No.
What?
I'm not sure what... I understand, don't go for the...
Well, I'm saying that let's not take that one particular one and go over and over and over again. And let's not take big explosions as the important thing. Let's look at when we're meditating. Do you see that little kleshas are happening all the time, and each time we have to return to the breath? So how are these organized? And so we start to talk about that. We're talking about the eight worldly concerns. Yeah.
I want to go back to love. And I asked this question a couple of weeks ago.
Yes.
You just said love and compassion. Those aren't kleshas. As if, like, those are good guys. But where does love can get you? When you said, oh, anytime it's a story about me, and boy, love is a klesha? Or is there another word for it here? I'm not sure I understand where that goes.
Well, I think if it's gain,
So if it's if it's just love, I care for someone, and it's, you know, purely just that love, I care for someone. That's not a klesha. But I love them, and they should be my partner, and then we're going to go do all these wonderful things together because we would make this great couple. Then it's all about I want to have that.
So that you would say, okay, so that helps me. That would fall perhaps under gain.
Yeah.
Pleasure, all those kinds of things.
I think if you look at all the four pairs of opposites, they can all tie into love in some context.
That's good.
Yeah.
And furthermore, there's a pattern of wandering around in them, right? Why don't you explain
that?
Yeah.
Well, I think, in any type, regardless of the love, there are going to be moments of pleasure there, but there could also be the contrast where something gets lost within that, and then it turns into pain because of the love and the pleasure that's there that might shift and become lost.
Okay, so what's happening to me?
What's up?
What's happening to me?
Yeah.
Wherever the me is, what's going on with it? The kleshas are all about me. So what's happening? I want, right?
Right, I want the pleasure, and if it's not there, then it could turn into the pain.
And I don't want.
And I don't want the pain.
Push away.
I don't want to be pushed away. I want that love. I want that person to love me, and I don't want to be.
And when they don't, it's all their fault.
And then I feel insignificant. Well, but then there's insignificance. I mean, he's right. Then insignificance, or it's all my fault, or this is causing me pain, or I'm going to lose this person. So, you're right.
So I'm
going
to get angry?
I'm going to get
angry.
I want to be understood.
What?
I want to be understood and have my mind read.
I want to be understood and have my mind read.
I want to be understood, yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have lots of things we want. And lots of things we don't want. We don't want pain, we want pleasure. We want to gain the things that are desirable, and we don't want to lose them, or miss them, or not get them.
I think what comes up for me a lot in meditation is loss, and thinking about, mostly about people that I'm attached to, and maybe in a good way, but then I get this whole, someday soon or recently, I'll lose them, they'll die. It's like a big, it's small, and then sometimes it gets very big, but that happens a lot.
That's why you could look at love as like a klesha, because eventually everything comes to an end at some point, in terms of like a material form.
Right.
Yeah.
There's a long Louis C.K. riff on that.
What's that?
Louis C.K.? Yeah. It's a long time. He does a comedy stand-up routine about why is it worth loving anybody. He takes that argument, too.
Yeah.
And absurd. And, sorry. So.
It seems to me if you think of the code word or the critical word affliction, you defined it as a conflicted emotion.
Yeah.
So if I can focus on the affliction or the confliction of whatever I'm experiencing, then it's going to eventually reduce to appear like these four. So you can take anything like love or whatever possessiveness you want, and that's the essence is what's the affliction. And then somehow every affliction comes down to a couplet of these four. Is that seems to me that way?
Because they're about me, and the world is always going to frustrate me in some way. I won't get what I want. I'll lose what I have.
I'll get what I don't want.
Yep. I'll be blamed for it. Wow.
I'll take care of that part.
don't want to be blamed for it. It's his fault. I want everyone to praise me. So it's all about me. And then what's that fourth one?
Fame and insignificance.
Yeah. Okay, I want to be famous.
That's one of my big ones. I think it's so in our culture that we all have to, oh, what do you do? You know, and I remember, now that I'm older, I don't care about that so much, but you know, you meet people when you're in your 30s, what do you do? And you have to have a really good answer. Mm-hmm. So there, you want to have some feeling of significance. Mm-hmm. Boy, that's a real stuff.
Oh, I'm a great rock star. I'm a great surgeon or
whatever. Mm-hmm.
I don't want to be an insignificant, unrecognized person.
And I realize that goes down, that happens a lot. Like, am I included in that group? Oh, I wasn't invited to that dinner. Nobody told me. I didn't get that call. No, I didn't get the email. Did you? You know, there's all these things that just can push that insignificant button in our society.
Any society, because some Tibetans made that list a long time ago, or an Indian made it before that, yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty universal.
It seems like sort of acting on that, the fear side of it, is what causes us so much trouble. You know, like when I get really worried about avoiding something, and then I start acting in a way to avoid a bad consequence, then that's when, I feel like that's when a lot of trouble starts, because mm-hmm. you start living to avoid things instead of going after the good side of things.
Plus there's the fear that can be so, you know, sort of under, and then there are a few places where it's like big, and you're like, well, of course I'm afraid of driving there because people don't drive well in Boston, as opposed to like, I am afraid every second of every day. Mm-hmm. Like, that's there all the time, but I don't want to look at that. You know, it pops up, and oh my God, how that happens.
Yeah.
I'm a confident. Yeah.
But we do live a lot of our lives avoiding something.
Right. But we don't. We want to avoid going.
Right.
But is that, why is that, is that a fear of getting what you don't want that's going to stand in the way of getting what you do want? Is that what that means?
What if it's bad?
Does that make sense, that question?
Yeah.
Notice that hope and fear are poles that we get caught between. Somewhere there's a phrase, the bandits of hope and fear, which are driving us.
Well, hope implies that something is missing.
Yeah.
Something's not good enough, mm-hmm. and that you're, in a sense, afraid of whatever is not good enough. Right?
Right. We can't have one side of the coin without the other.
Mm-hmm. And so what's it? I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah. What's the difference then between the energy you talk about that's sort of fundamental to the universe and all these other, you know, what I would call energies too, all the fears and hopes, all the afflictions that seem to be energy too?
Well, fear or hope or anything we experience without the reference of me is not a klesha. And the me is always a storyline. That's why the eight are such a useful way to take apart the storyline, because every little bit of it has to do with me. Yeah.
Did you say the emotion without the story is a klesha?
No.
Okay, I thought.
No.
The story.
It's the story that it's the story added on top of the original energy something, an unnecessary twist to it.
Yes.
Okay? A way we take it. Not the fact that there's things happening all the time, but that we twist it into the reference.
It doesn't seem like it's possible, I guess, to ever escape that to me.
Well, maybe.
I mean,
maybe it is.
That's some nice ideal from Buddha, but it doesn't seem realistic in my life. I mean, I can do maybe the path, you know.
Okay.
That would be,
yeah.
And, you know, and feet, it would be like, wait, and I would like to do my little tiny steps here, maybe. It would be like a zillion miles away forever.
Well, maybe it's not a zillion miles away. Let's take it under advisement for now, because it may not be as far as one suspects. But we got a lot of work to do.
But it may be very close, too. It may be the moment you notice, like you want to get the prize or you want to get whatever. It's that noticing, and that so that you start to have awareness of what... where your mind goes and how, you know, these actually pop up. So that it's very close in that way. Once you have awareness, that's the beginning, that there's they're seeing it.
I guess, so what? You know, I mean, you know, awareness of how, you know, angry and miserable and mean-spirited I am. That's wonderful.
Well, I think there are going to be some new techniques that we're going to teach. Okay, so we're going to go further. Don't worry.
I can find moments of peace in meditation. Not
okay,
that
that can happen. Yes,
but that, you know, feels more like the, you know, zillion miles away. You know, I might get little flashes.
Okay,
what that would be.
Yeah.
But the you know, the awareness.
Okay, we should move on a little bit because there's a lot.
Okay.
So, what we want to talk about are different ways of viewing emotions, viewing klesha and working with them. So the first one is klesha as poison, and that's what we've been working on here. The klesha is something that obscures our mind, keeps us from realizing our own nature, generates unnecessary confusion. Kleshas cause us to harm ourselves and others. They sap our original energy. We spend so much effort dealing with them. They can depress us. So we need to see klesha very clearly, and we need, the first step is to become, is to realize how unaware we are of the constant stream of it. And that's very hard work, and it's very humbling work, to take the trouble to see that. We can use our meditation to do it. So we need mindfulness. And what mindfulness means is seeing the klesha as it arises rather than not noticing it, being controlled by it but not noticing it, or only knowing about it afterwards. Mindfulness is the key to going forward, because it's what tells us the klesha is happening as it arises. So, of course, meditation is a very powerful tool, because our instruction is when a thought or emotion comes up, it doesn't matter whether it's got a lot of juice or just a boring little one. What is our instruction? To glance at it. Not ignore it, but glance at it. That doesn't mean elaborating, but just instantly recognize it and go back to being here. So that is our genuine renunciation, being willing to go back to our breath. It's our genuine discipline and the thing we most have to do in order to generate awareness of klishas. And it can catch on. We can find that this flash of awareness comes at some other time, and wonder of wonders, we suddenly find that we're free. We could act in some way other than we usually react. and I'm sure you have experienced this, a freedom not to follow a destructive habit, but to find some other way of relating to a person or dealing with a situation. So we all do go beyond the klesha, at times at least. So I'd like to read at this point about mindfulness. And this book is called The Way of the Bodhisattva. It was written by Shantideva, who lived in India during the 7th century CE. And I'm going to read just a little bit, and I did put this up on the web, by the way. It's already there. So this chapter is called Vigilance, which is actually mindfulness. Lack of vigilance is like a thief who slinks behind when mindfulness abates. In all the merit we have gathered in, he steals, and down we go to the lower realms. Defilements are a band of robbers waiting for their chance to bring us injury. They steal our virtue when their moment comes and batter out the life of happy destinies. Therefore, from the gateway of awareness, mindfulness shall not have leave to stray. And if it wanders, it shall be recalled by thoughts of anguish in the lower worlds. Good motivation to be mindful.
Itself seems negative.
Pardon?
It seems we're just going to try to remember to do this to avoid the anguish.
Okay, so yeah, to avoid being trapped forever in kleshas. Okay.
Mm. Or have your virtue, so they'd use that word virtue, but it's like goodness taken away because you're wrapped up in these harmful things. So that's the thief.
Mm. But it also seems like you've got to be unguarded and protect yourself, so it seems like it's also feeding into a klesha.
Or be aware.
So of course we have to deal with not too tight, not too loose somehow. When the urge arises in the mind to feelings of desire or wrathful hate, do not act, be silent, do not speak, and like a log of wood, be sure to stay. When the mind is wild with mockery and filled with pride and haughty arrogance, and when you want to show the hidden faults of others, to bring up old dissensions or to act deceitfully, and when you want to fish for praise, or criticize and spoil another's name, or use harsh language sparring for a fight, it's then that like a log you should remain. And when you yearn for wealth, attention, fame, a circle of admirers serving you, and when you look for honors, recognition, it's then that like a log you should remain. And when you want to do another down and cultivate advantage for yourself, and when the wish to gossip comes to you, it's then that like a log you should remain. Impatience, indolence, faint-heartedness, and likewise haughty speech and insolence, attachment to your side, when these arise, it's then that like a log you should remain. Examine thus yourself from every side. Note harmful thoughts and every futile striving. Thus it is that heroes in the bodhisattva path apply the remedies to keep a steady mind. That's quite a list, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So he went through quite a few of those. Anyone want to offer a comment? We could move, yeah.
Just a clarification. So last week you used the term mindful gap, or one of you did, and I thought that was great. That's what this is talking about, right? It's the having the wherewithal to take a moment when you feel like you're going to make a fool of yourself.
Yeah.
And just pause and think.
Right. It's like giving a child a little time out. But It can be done very quickly. Okay, so that's the first view, which is seeing the emotions as poison, seeing what they do to us, seeing the klesha as harmful, bringing it to mind so that we know what's going on. This is very largely a matter of knowing what's happening in our own mind rather than not knowing and just throwing it out there somewhere. So the second view is that kleshas are useful. So working to avoid them, to put this mindful gap into place, is very useful and important. But it's also true we could do it for a long, long time, and it might not be enough. It might take lifetimes to eventually wear it all down. So the second view is that kleshas are helpful because when they come up, we can actually work with them. Or we can even intentionally bring them up for the purpose of working with them. So this is like a farmer who composts his waste rather than paying someone to cart it away. That's another very useful analogy, thanks to Chogyam Trungpa. So there is a possibility of deliberate contemplative work with kleshas. And the most famous one, which we will actually be working on presently, is called Lojong, or mind training, and we did a bit of it again in the spring of 2014. Lojong comes from a great Indian master named Atisha, whose life spanned the 10th and 11th centuries AD. So the practice he gave, which is mindfulness training or Lojong, consists of a lot of pithy contemplations, reminders, which we can work with, and then maybe they'll come up all of a sudden when they're useful. And in the form we've inherited it, there are actually, I think, 52? Is that 56. The number? 56?
59. Okay. See, I remembered. I'm better than everyone.
Ooh. And they're not as good as you.
And they happen to be organized under seven broad categories. And we will work with that. So they're actually, instead of just putting a gap in and going back and saying, oh, that's a klesha, we can actually take hold of them and start to twist them. So we will work with these. And just, they're all about taking the klesha. Even if you have to deliberately cough it up to look at it, you take this klesha and we go, flip. We turn it upside down and we reverse the self and other aspect of it. And then that's the way to get into big trouble. It's actually wonderful to do it. So here, instead of just boycotting the story about me, we flip it over and tonight we'll just talk briefly about one of them. And that one is drive all blames into oneself. And who likes that idea?
Not me.
Yes, some of us we do that.
So it's already on our list, right? Blaming others is one of the our most basic habits, which we do all the time. I know from prison workers who go in and hear the prisoner's story, every prisoner there has a story of how it's someone else is to blame for why they ended up there. They were falsely accused, or their mother didn't love them enough, or whatever. There's always a, it's always someone else's fault. And we see that in behavior of children in school. We see it all over the place. We see it in courtrooms. So here, yes?
We have the issue of sometimes blaming ourselves too much. And
well,
sort of where sometimes it's a little bit more realistic to say, hey, it wasn't all my fault. This was just, some of it was just things that happened.
Okay, so if it just happened, okay, but if we want to work with the klesha, we do the exercise. We don't let ourselves off the hook by saying, oh, well, it just happened. We work, actually work with the klesha. We take on everything that happens as I can hold the blame. I'm big enough so I can hold the blame. As soon as we do that, first of all, we take enormous responsibility for our own lives. It actually has that effect. It starts us realizing that everyone else out there has storylines. As soon as we do this, we realize everyone else is suffering the same as I'm suffering and trying to avoid being blamed for it. So it generates compassion because we start to see that I'm not really different than anyone else. I can overcome my own egocentricity. It may do more than that. It may act, yeah.
Is it possible to drop the blame thing altogether and just move on?
Well, do you just want to move on or do you want to liberate yourself?
Do I want to what?
Do you just want to move on and say, oh, well, you know, that doesn't make sense. Let's just drop it. Or do you want to...
I use the term like, you know, it's just the way the cookie crumbled.
Oh, well, then okay.
It's their fault or my fault to internalize things.
Yeah, that can be...
Okay, then you can move on until you come to the next cookie. And then you can move on until you come
it's
to the next
training.
Cookie.
It's training. The point here, it's training. So what you're noticing is the first thought that comes up when something happens, it's like, oh, it's that one's fault or it's that one's fault. It's just this instantaneous habitual pattern not to realize, not to to blame somebody else. It's all, so you're flipping that tendency. So in a way it's exaggerated because you're saying drive all blames into one. But it's sort of piling it on in a way so that you experience that in kind of the opposite way that you usually do.
I've been trying to develop a pattern of looking at my pot in a scenario, but there's something with the word blame that I'm struggling with. Mm-hmm. You know, certainly what's my pot in this scenario, and what can I change about myself to bring about a different scenario? But the blame.
Maybe this is also another aspect. As Emily said, this is the training process. These are slogans that are used for training. And the notion of driving all blames into oneself is not personally blaming yourself for everything that occurs. But as long as there's blame, take it in so that you're removing the blame from you're diffusing the whole thing from, you know, generating anger and demanding redress and justification and all the other stuff. You're just pulling that out of the process. As Michael responded to your first question, it's like, do you want to just move, just ignore this issue of blame? The problem is blame doesn't go away. It's still there. It's still in your face whether you want to accept it or not. So the idea of taking blame into oneself is not assuming that I'm responsible for all of this, but actually recognizing, and at the same time, we're training in flexibility so that we're not just going to load more and more personal pain and suffering on ourselves. We realize at this point we already are loosening up our notion of self. We're not talking about this for people who haven't started practicing meditation or who haven't begun to examine the nature of their mind. This is not a good idea for people like that. I mean, that could be problematic. But, you know, when you realize that fundamentally, as we've discussed, no ego, we can't find this ego. We just, it's a mythology, it's an assumption we're carrying around. When we realize that's the case, we have room to absorb all blames because there's nobody there to have to get patched up with it. It's not like we're suddenly
doesn't stick
mummified with, you know, all these blames and stuck into a casket forever. It's more about just recognizing there's no problem. It's just pulling the blame situation out. When there's nobody blaming each other, then suddenly everybody in the situation, you, I, and everybody else, actually starts looking at this differently.
So are you saying then is this pulling in, driving all blames into one, is this like feeling that pain of blame without a storyline?
Well,
he's taking away the story.
That's exactly. Feel the blame.
Well, if the story is the feeling, if you pull the blame out, the story out of the blame, then where does all this pain and suffering come from? You know, it's like nobody's being nailed for being responsible for doing something. We're actually just trying to understand what actually is going on. It's a very different situation. When we're not sitting in court in a judgment situation, where we're removing the judgment process. That's actually what that refers to. It's not like that I'm responsible, it's my fault. You know, when somebody gets in an argument, okay, you know, that doesn't resolve anything. It's not like that. That's not what it's referring to.
In some ways, it's likened to something I think you guys were speaking about earlier in terms of the eight worldly concerns, is that these are things just happening. Where we get into trouble is when when we have a relationship with pain, with pleasure, and when one is able to not have that relationship and just, you know, I equate it to what we're just speaking about now with my brain has just left me, but with regards to this idea, this current idea, that it's drive all blames into one. It's about the relationship.
It's about going beyond that. So yeah. Michael made two important points here. One is, this is a practice that we do after we've spent some time looking at our mind, looking at our kleshas. So the first way, seeing the kleshas as poison, has to be well worked. We can't just jump into this. And then finally, it's going beyond blame altogether. It starts to question the notion of, is there a self? Without having to get theological or bookish about it, it starts to take your mind into the idea, is this notion of self that I'm holding on to really what's happening? Or am I starting to see holes in it?
Right.
So it's a pretty powerful practice. And it's practice which requires effort and energy. You have to want to do this, okay? You have to want to move beyond where we're stuck habitually and not just go on, okay, let's happen, go on to the next thing. It's really making trouble in a very, very delightful way, moving beyond our habits, breaking apart what we don't need.
So are words like detaching or separating from the, in this case, blaming, just being able to kind of pull away from it?
Well, we brought the blame in.
And
you have to try it, okay? Instead of trying to come up with a theory about it.
Yes.
Bring that blame in. What does it feel like? See how resentful it feels. See how wonderful it feels, whatever. Mm-hmm. See how it actually teaches you about other people, opens your mind to what they're going through. Mm-hmm. And then maybe, like Jesus, you can say, I take all the blame.
So it's really like someone does something that pisses you off, you're ready to tell them what a jerk they are, and you think, oh, me, what a jerk I am. And sort of yell it, do that sort of talking to yourself to think about, like, what does that do?
I don't think so.
No, quite not.
Michael's kind of jumping the gun here on some level, because these slogans are sequential. And before you get to driving all blames into one, you have to understand the nature of your mind, or you have to have worked with some training around the nature of your mind, realizing fundamentally that you can't, there's this mind is fundamentally open, and it's without any kind of entity inside that we call me. This is the basis for what's called an absolute slogan, because it's basis for how you can easily absorb all, you can accommodate all this blame. You're not trying to like just, you know, blame myself because somebody else pissed you off. Uh-huh. It's about just getting it out of the situation so that you can actually see clearly what it is that's going on. We're not trying to blame anybody at that point. You're pulling the blame out of the situation.
Okay. You get it. Owning your own clashes.
What?
You're owning your own clashes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're owning them, you're eating them, whatever. Yeah.
And it starts with openness. So I think Michael Fagan's point's a good one. You know, we're just giving one example here, and we're just touching on a different view of working with kleshas. But we aren't really teaching the full path tonight around that. But we will. We're going to start. We will be working more with this. And it really starts with the absolute view. So that's back to emptiness and non-self, and you know, that's the first part of those teachings. Everything rests with that as a starting point, and then all the slogans follow from that. So that is a full body of teachings, and we are going to work with that more thoroughly. But right now, we're just really presenting. We're working with the Dzogchen Pumat Rinpoche material, which is the view, these different ways of working with emotion. So you're getting a view here of the several, it's progressive, there's a progression here. And it has to do with your own understanding and realization along the way. But it helps to just hear them, you know, even if we can't do it. Yes.
Yeah, I was going to say, kind of an example with how I relate to this kind of stuff. Like a few nights ago, I was driving through a light, and I was going straight, and I was trying to make the yellow light. And then another guy on the other side of the road was turning, and he was trying to make the yellow light as well. And I skidded in the middle of the road, and like time slowed. I stared at, like, we looked each other in the eye, and then nothing happened. But instantly, my mind started going off and telling a story about, okay, I could have got an accident. I was trying to pay for my car. Like, all these things just started going off. But when in reality, nothing at all happened. So, and even if I had gotten in a car accident, then there would have been a whole story behind that. It would have been, again, how am I going to pay for this? It was this guy's fault. Yada, yada, yada. Or you can look at it, and what really happened was there are molecules in the fender of my car just got banged up a little bit. And that's really it. No, like, everything else is just stuff going on in your head.
Well, that's a huge story. It has many, many, many parts. Drive all blames into oneself is an instantaneous thing. That is...
Right.
I'm not going to go blame someone. It doesn't matter what the plot is. It doesn't matter what the story is. It doesn't matter whether you have a long narrative with 20 steps or whatever. I see blame arising in my mind, and I'm going to take it into myself.
Right, yeah. So, like, you could play into the story or the plot and it has 20 parts, or you could just be like, no, there is no story. It's just... Yeah.
You drop
the whole entire story because the story doesn't exist.
It punctures it. Right. It pops the whole thing.
Yeah, there is no story. You can't put your finger on the story. There's nothing.
But then do you lose the adrenaline? Because, I mean, I'm just thinking, if you come home after something like that and talk to somebody and they're saying, you seem awfully tense.
Yeah.
Well, yeah,
there's a story there.
I think your body reacts in a way that you feel in danger, so it's kind of a little pump, and that happens.
But that's not a story.
Yeah,
I've had some really very, very dangerous accidents, and the last one I got into was like, you know, I could have easily gotten killed, and just, you know, one of these things that just amazing it didn't happen. And I'm sitting here feeling all this energy, you know. I mean, like, that's okay. It's not like that's there's some problem with that. It's not, that energy is not going to go away because you practically got killed, but it's free from getting taken over by a klesha. You know, kleshas are specific emotional content. We're not talking about physical responses or adrenaline or, you know, other kinds.
But if Gary comes home and tells me about something like this, I expect to hear the story.
Well, okay, then you expect the story.
You know, I mean, it's
notice, then you...
What's happened, but then there's what's happened versus all the many spin-outs.
It's not about failing to learn what you could have done in a situation to make your driving safer, okay? Mm-hmm. That's we're not trying to kill that, okay?
No.
Anymore we're trying to kill any effective, useful part of your ability to function in the world. That's not what we're trying to, that's not what we're talking about. It's, why do I have to put energy into adding something to it? And blame is something which doesn't accomplish anything. It does. It makes lots of money for lawyers. It makes it really interesting to watch operas.
Yeah.
Okay, but when you watch the opera, you don't have to take it personally, okay? That's what's nice about the opera, or the soap opera, or whatever it is. That the kleshas are not happening to me. So we're taking a similar attitude towards ourselves. We're questioning whether this me really needs to be pampered the way we think it needs to be pampered. What happens if we go through the experience of taking the klesha into ourself? What will happen? And we need discipline first, that, and we need to at least touch on a more absolute view of things. We aren't going to master it. We still have to go into the relative. But we're moving towards questioning the self and starting to chip away at it. So, I'm not going to talk about the third view, which is the third way of working with kleshas is the view of alchemy or transmutation, which is to see kleshas directly as wisdom. Each klesha is already an aspect of our original nature, our Buddha nature. It manifests in a particular way, it has its particular color, energy, magic, strength, power. But this is not something we're going to go into right away. Do you wish to comment on it?
Oh, wow, now's your chance.
Now's your chance, then we're going to end.
How much time does he
have?
Yeah,
really, I don't know. We have a 3-hour response.
It would be a 3-hour response.
3 months response.
3 months. That's a whole teaching. But a good one, a good one.
It's a wonderful teaching on which called the five Buddha wisdoms.
The five wisdom energies, or the five Buddha family.
And I believe you did recite a couple of weeks ago the names of the wisdoms and the kleshas that went with them. But we don't have to do it now if you don't want to.
No. I think Michael is drumming in my head that we don't want anybody who will have to cope with more than 3 or 4 new ideas at a time. And I agree with this. If we try to talk about 25 new ideas, nobody's going to remember anything or take it home with them. And I think it's better that we stick to the salient points that actually we can work with and apply.
So the salient points are, we need to do the work of seeing kleshas as poisons, that we need to look at our mind very carefully, notice all the varieties of them, and see how they all have to do with me, and that there's only a short list of ways in which they're about me, which you have in your hand. And then we can, having done that and having put a lot of work into that, we can move on towards a second way, which is very much based on that, which is to start to take the kleshas and actually flip them into reversing them, which and heightening them very deliberately, which questions who is me, who is someone else, and as we do that, it actually generates compassion, generates understanding of other people, generates vast amount of awareness. It's a wonderful practice, and we're going to be doing that.
Is it necessary to go like step by step? So you have your three separate ways of.
It's necessary. It's yes. It's very necessary to know our mind before we can do anything else, like the slogan work. Okay, the mind training. It's very necessary. Otherwise, we don't know what we're doing.
But you don't. Sorry.
Yeah.
But you don't have to have, you know, the first thing completely understood before you can actually work with the second technique. So it's not that we attain perfection and then we can move on to get better beyond that. It's we can sit down, work with our mind, and we notice our meditation practice starts changing over time. The more we do it, the more we have a clarity in our mind and understand ourselves. So it's in the same way, each one of these teachings, they build on each other, but you don't have to attain perfection before you move on to the next one. So that's why we keep recycling the teachings, and we kind of will go through something and then we'll come back to it, because we don't get it the first time, you know, we don't get it the fifth time, but that's okay. Each time we learn a little more. So you just keep working with it all.
This is the way our teacher worked with us, Chogyam Trungpa. We really have to start with the basics. We have to put energy into it. We don't have to perfect it, but we have to really work on it until it starts to teach us something. Then we can go on to the next one and see what that has to teach us. But we're continuing to work on the first one also. And when we do the Lojong, we will have to start with some absolute slogans, but again, we don't perfect them before we move on. We start them, give a sample of that, and actually try to work with it, and then move on in sequence. So there are sequences, and there's a all-at-once aspect too. But it's not like you really have, until you completely know your arithmetic, you can't do algebra. So you have to graduate it. It doesn't work like that. Anything else? Should we dedicate the merit?
Okay.
Okay, who needs a piece of paper for that?